Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And you know, every country has its customs and traditions surrounding food, and none more special to me than Italy. Having lived in Rome for a period of time, ages ago, I have a special fondness for Italian cuisine and its traditions. And that includes keeping up on the latest happenings in the Roman restaurant world when I do travel. And I was fortunate enough to be able to travel to Rome last month. And while I was there, I also had the opportunity to sit down and visit with someone who knows the latest happenings in restaurants very well. She is food and travel writer, Elizabeth Minchiele. And Elizabeth has just published a fun and very informative book called Eating Rome. And she joins me today by telephone from that eternal city. Elizabeth, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me, Linda.
Well, it was so much fun to visit with you and hear firsthand some of your impressions of what's going on today in the food scene in Rome. But through your book and through your travel apps, it's, you know, one discovers so much more. And that is that there really is a tradition and such a history. Well, history goes without saying in that city. But there are many different, I guess, kind of cultural traditions surrounding a lot of the food of Italy. And you started out, you still do a lot of, when I say like shelter writing, garden and home decor type writing. What made you venture into the food world?
Well, I've actually always been writing about food. I think probably my work writing about design and architecture and gardens probably was a little bit more well-known just because I've written 6 books on the subject. But I've always been writing about food for magazines like Bon Appetit and Food and Wine. And I've always been a pretty accomplished cook myself.
That's
accomplished eater, for sure. And so I've been writing about restaurants and things for a long time. And when I sort of made the move to write almost only about food was when I started my blog, which was 5 years ago. And at that point, I sort of had to decide what the blog was going to be about, what aspect of my life. And it almost wasn't a decision. It came quite naturally. People were asking me lots of questions at the time, and all the questions had to do with food. Although they might be cultural at their base, they wanted real practical information, like what are your favorite restaurants in Rome? How do you cook that eggplant? Things like that. And so the blog sort of turned in to being predominantly about food in a very natural and organic way.
It just took on a life of its own, right?
It did.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of the main portions of my suitcase whenever I would travel, of course, would always be the heavy and multiple guidebooks, but now you've even ventured even further into that food writing and travel writing, where you've developed or written apps for dining in many different cities. Tell me about those.
Well, I started writing, I've always had that little list that I would give to people. And back in the day when we actually used paper, the list would get printed out and faxed to people, and then eventually became something I would send via email until, the whole possibility of writing an app became possible. And I thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity for me to keep my list, keep it updated, and actually start charging people for it, which was a bonus.
Yeah.
And so I started out with writing an app to Rome called Eat Rome, and that was successful. So I followed up with Eat Florence and Eat Venice, and those three apps have been bestsellers on iTunes almost since I wrote them. And just recently, last month, I was sort of pushed to expand them. And I've changed them a bit, and I've now written an app called Eat Italy. And within that app, you're able to buy the different cities. So I still have Florence, Venice, and Rome, but I'm adding cities and regions. And my first new city that I've added is Eat Milan. And I've done this because I think about 1 billion people in the world are headed towards Milan to go see Expo, and I figured they'd like to know, places to eat. But also just because I love Milan, and I think people often overlook it as a destination, a culinary destination, which it should be in its own right.
Well, you certainly are saving us on paying any extra freight to have all those books, those restaurant guidebooks with us. I mean, it truly is such a convenience to just open your phone and have a little travel app. But
have a little me in your back pocket.
That's right. There you go. But what I loved about your book so much is that you give such interesting little anecdotes and truly historical background information that a lot of people don't understand about, some of those cultural traditions that I referred to earlier. And when I was in Rome last month, we met in a coffee shop. And you have a wonderful chapter about coffee and the whole etiquette of ordering a coffee and when you drink the coffee. Tell us a little bit about the whole coffee culture.
Well, one of the most perplexing things I find for people who are coming to Rome and Italy in general for the first time, it's a completely different way of having coffee. And where a lot of people, their first misconception is that there is no takeout coffee. So once you get over that sort of hump, if you go into a bar, a coffee bar, and you order a coffee, it's very perplexing how you get that coffee from the machine, into your hands, because there's etiquette. There's written rules to it. For instance, most people go into a coffee shop and they go up to the counter and they order their coffee directly from the barista and they drink it standing up. And it seems simple, but before you actually get to that barista, you have to go to a second counter where there's often a woman sitting behind a cash register who's probably on the phone or having her own conversation.
Or petting her dog.
You have to tell her exactly what coffee you'd like first, then you pay for it. Then she gives you a tiny little piece of paper, which you walk over and hopefully get the barista's attention, at which point, he'll ask you what you want, and only then will he give you your coffee. Now, God forbid you should take your coffee and go sit down at a table, which would be sort of the normal North American response to this, because if you want to sit down at a table, there's a whole different set of rules to follow. And so seeing people, I sort of took pity on them to sort of explain this in the book.
Yeah, well, and it was very kind, because it is a confusing, it's a confusing etiquette for people who aren't familiar with it. And then again, there are people who love their types of coffee any time of day. However, if you're in Rome, someone's going to point you out as definitely an outsider or a tourist if you order a cappuccino after lunch, correct?
Well, correct. Because people get a little bit, nasty about it too. They sort of demand their cappuccino after lunch, and most people will serve it to you. But there's actually reason behind this, and it's not anything that's snobby. Like most things in Italy that have to do with food, it all comes down to digestion and health. And the thinking is that the last thing in the world you would want after a big lunch, which is lunch, is a big cup of warm milk, which is basically what cappuccino is. So for the Italians, the thought, that after you'd have maybe pasta, maybe a second course, a dessert, that you would then, on top of that, have something that is very difficult to digest for most adults, which is milk, is a little bit perplexing. So they'll give it to you, but they'll be very disapproving.
Right.
And worried at the same time.
Right. How in the world is that person going to be able to digest them? Right. Exactly. So instead you get your little shot of espresso, and you definitely don't sip it, but you just shoot it down.
Yep.
And that's why it's called a shot of espresso. You shoot it down, right? We're talking about etiquette. There is another type of etiquette that you referred to, traditional shopping etiquette at markets, open markets. Now, open markets, one would think that, oh, well, Rome, you know, always has open outdoor markets. But they, much like in urban areas everywhere, they sort of, you know, came and went, and now they're back in vogue again. But you found quite a procedure of, well, not etiquette, if you will, but kind of like the rules to getting what you want in the outdoor market. That's a story.
Well, in fact, yes, because, you know, you go to these outdoor markets, and in fact, there aren't a lot of outdoor markets left anymore. And but when you're there, you have this feeling, oh, it's outside, it's free, everybody's picking their fruits and vegetables, but that's not the case at all. God forbid you should go up and grab your own piece of fruit, because that's just not done.
Or touch it, right?
You know, if you go to a market and you see the different stands, there's usually an older woman or man or a couple behind them, and you wait in line patiently, and then you tell them what you'd like. And not only do you have to know what you would like, you have to know exactly the amount, too. So that's a whole other chapter in my book about learning quantities. But just back to actually the what, let's say you would like a kilo of tomatoes, 2 pounds of tomatoes. Your first instinct would be to, you know, you'd sort of touch them, pick them. Well, no, in a market, you have to trust the woman to give you the tomatoes she thinks you deserve or that you should have. And, you know, sometimes this is based on a conversation. She'll ask you what you're cooking, when you're going to be eating that melon. Is it for tonight? Is it for tomorrow? But another part of it is who you are. And who you are you her client? Have you shown her loyalty? Do you come here every single day and buy your fruits and vegetables from her? At which point, she starts to give you the better fruits and vegetables, and you don't have to worry about it so much. But the thing you do have to worry is you don't want to cross her, because, you know, I learned this the hard way. One time I went to the market, and I'd been going to the same woman for quite a long time, and she didn't have, I forget what it was, she didn't have asparagus maybe. And so I went to the stand next to her and bought a pound of asparagus, and then I went back to her and bought the rest of my groceries, you know, tomatoes and peaches and things. And so I went back home, and sure enough, at the bottom of the bag, where there was, you know, one rotten peach, because she'd seen me cheating on her, like, on somebody else, and she sort of not so subtly let me know what was going on.
Well, I mean, it's one way to build your business, but boy, it makes it tough to be a selective shopper, that's for sure.
Well, you just have to know the rules and follow them, then you'll be fine.
Yeah. You know, the rules of... they're all not rules, but again, as I say, you know, customs and traditions that, you know, it's easy to just slide into, but, you know, you have to sort of look around you and look and see what everyone else is doing. And that even includes often eating in a restaurant. You sort of look around and see, well, let me see, what are the people who look like they're Italians? What are they ordering and how are they ordering? And of course, you can all just throw all abandon to the wind and just say, hey, I'm here. I want to eat what I want, and I'm ordering the way I want. You know, no one will frown at you. A waiter will occasionally, I'm sure, give a skewed look, right?
But one of the things, well, for instance, I get a lot of questions from people, and they say, well, how do you stay so thin? How do Italians stay thin eating all that pasta, you know, at meals? But then, you know, I'll be in an Italian restaurant, and I'll look here in Rome, and I'll look around, and I'll see all the Americans that are there, and before the food even comes to the table, they've eaten the entire bread basket. And they ask for oil to dip the bread in. And this is something that Italians, especially Romans, would never think of doing. They would never think of having bread with oil before a meal. And so when the Americans say, oh, the pasta's, you know, it's too heavy, it's too much to finish, well, you know, you shouldn't have eaten that basket of bread before it got there. And I hear this again and again from restaurant owners here in Rome, and it's a real cultural difference, I think. And instead, the Americans that are coming here, they're used to having a big basket of bread or breadsticks or whatever at their local Italian restaurant. But it's really an Italian-American thing. It's not an Italian thing.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yet the Italians, well, they will put it down, you know, in on the table oftentimes.
Well, they put it down there because it's there for your second course and your salad.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's restraint. They would not, you know, it's not a snack. It's not an antipasto, and it's not meant to be eaten with your pasta. It's meant to be eaten with either meat or a vegetable.
All right. There are, you know, we were talking about the markets, and I just wanted to go back to that a minute. Because there, over the years, and we're talking like over the past 30, 40 years, there has been quite an influx of supermarkets, and Italians are now doing a lot more shopping at their supermarkets. Do you think, does this account for the fact that there aren't so many open markets anymore? And how do you see that?
Oh, yes, it's absolutely related. The markets themselves, you know, that were here in the, you know, for most of the part of the last century, they sort of started dying out a bit after World War II, when the centers of the city started to, people, if they could afford to move to nicer housing on the outskirts of towns, they did. And the places where we're seeing now, you know, that are these multi-million-dollar beautiful apartments in the center of Rome, they used to be, you know, apartments that would house extended families, you know, 10, 15, 20 people in these apartments. And that was a very dense population that kept these open markets going. Mm. So once this population in the center of the town started to go down, that sort of affected the markets, and they started to shrink slowly. But the big changes really came in when the lira switched over to the euro. And that made it possible for a lot of the big supermarket chains to really move into Italy in a big way. And I've seen this in Rome. Huh. So people who, they've taken over, you know, mom-and-pop stores with little chains, but they've also opened pretty big supermarkets. And the thing is, you know, people now, if you're a family and the woman is working, which is also a big change in how people are living now, the women work as well. If you're a family that doesn't have much time to shop, chances are you're going to head to the supermarket, which has longer hours, cheaper prices. And that's one of the big changes. And so that means that who's really using these open markets? And in the end, is selling fruits and vegetables, you know, how do you make a living selling zucchini and apples?
Yeah.
That's another problem in the center of a big city. So it's sort of a lot of pressure on these markets.
Right.
At the same time, luckily in the last few years, we've seen a rebound of farmers markets. Not to be confused with the open markets that existed previously. Instead, these farmers markets are partially subsidized by the farmers unions here in Italy. And they've seen a rebirth of interest in people wanting to buy local food, wanting to buy organic food. And these markets, which are only open on Saturdays and Sundays, are really crowded. And people, I think that shows sort of a rebirth of this interest in buying quality food from the source.
Right. I mean, that's always been the foundation of Italian cooking, is start with the best ingredient. So they're still in search of those who really pride themselves on cooking good dishes are searching for
absolutely
the best ingredients, right? Right.
Well, absolutely.
We're going to talk more about the food, particularly restaurants and meats, when we come back after a short break. So don't go away.
Raised by the rays of the falling sun, cruel outrage about your Cupid, they snapped the killer of the mighty Python. So a typical to Tripoli, ain't nice or hard, turns the other tail. This animal's the god to glory, is so much less than mine.
You are listening to Daphne and Apollo by Adetta Hartman. This is A Taste of the Past on heritageradionetwork.org.
Shoulders and low to have anything to do with men. Love pierced Apollo, Sorrento. So a typical to Tripoli. Ignites your heart and turns the other tail. This animal's a god to glory, is so much less than mine. Animal's a god to glory, is so much less than mine. Thank you.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
We are back. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Minchili from Rome. And Elizabeth, looks like you have your competition set out for you. We got gardening apps now as well as dining apps. we were talking about the markets, and of course, meat markets are something that started an interesting tradition of dishes, and the meat market that was originally in the Testaccio neighborhood, the meatpacking district. Uh-huh. There was a lot of interesting dishes that arose from the butchers there.
It's interesting that it's not actually the butchers there that were you know leading the new dishes, but it's actually the people who were working in the slaughterhouses themselves,
who
would be paid in kind with meat. And not just that, obviously, if you're being paid in meat, they're not going to give you the prime cut. So what would happen is they would give them the fifth quarter of the animal. And if you think of, there's no such thing as a fifth quarter. So the fifth quarter was actually the offal or the parts that got thrown away. And these dishes, these cuts of meat gave rise to certain dishes out of necessity, of a kind of cucina povera.
Mm. And some of those dishes they were served in some of the local restaurants in that neighborhood in Testaccio. Now you find them in a lot of different restaurants in different neighborhoods, right? Can you describe the different dishes?
Of the offal, yeah. I mean, one of the iconic is tripa alla romana, which is tripe. And in Rome, the tripe is tripe is eaten all over Italy, but in Rome, it's a specific dish that's made with a little sprinkling of pecorino cheese and also mint, which makes it very distinctive. Another dish that you find is something called coratella. And coratella is a seasonal offal dish, because people sort of think of meat as being all, all year long, but certain cuts of meat you only consume different times of year. And coratella is the liver, the lungs, and the heart of a baby lamb. And so the lambs are slaughtered in the spring. So coratella is something you eat in the spring. And since it is in the spring, you often eat it sautéed with artichokes, which are also a springtime vegetable.
Mm, wow, sounds delicious. That I did not have, although I was there for artichoke season. And that's interesting because a lot of people, other than, for artichokes, don't think of vegetables as having a major spot on the Italian plate, and yet meat is not eaten in abundance. It's not the center of the plate. It's often to the side of the plate, and vegetables are a big part of it. Correct?
Correct. Yes, vegetables are a very big part of it, not just Italian cuisine, but Roman cuisine specifically. And it's funny because people always ask me, they're here on vacation, they go into restaurants, and they say, "But we never see any vegetables. Why aren't there ever any vegetables?" Because you order your pasta, then you order your main course, and they don't come with vegetables, and people don't see them on the menu either. And the thing that you don't realize is that vegetables are actually so important to Romans that they're communicated verbally by the waiter because they change every day. And so Romans really know to say, what is there as a side dish today? And the waiter will, reel off the five or six seasonal vegetables that they have, and then, people will order them. But it's often something that goes missing if you're not in the know.
Yeah, correct. You talk about restaurants that you like, and they tend to be a lot of the older traditional restaurants, and you live in a very ancient part of the city. And you like the old kind of the old school trotters. Not to say that you don't appreciate the innovative restaurants, but you gave a nice little story about, well, talked about the history of Osteria and Trattoria, which a lot of people are not aware of, and the difference between a ristorante, a restaurant, and a trattoria, but that trattorias in Austria started out a little differently from what they are today. Can you talk about
that? Well, the original osterie were a place where you could come, bring your own food, and they were places that actually served wine and maybe had a table, and you would bring your own food, and by food, I mean it could be just as much as a hunk of bread and an onion, you know, if you're a worker, and you could buy, you know, a little glass of wine or, you know, a half a liter of wine and be on your way. And eventually, these people who had these places would start serving very, very, very simple food. Whether it's, you know, pasta or maybe eventually a second course. And these were the first restaurants and the first osteria and the trattoria that started springing up in Rome. And, you know, up until very recently, I mean 20 years ago, there were still a lot of these really simple places, you know, that had paper tablecloths and chunky glasses and with no reservations and you know, squished-in tables. Those, sadly, are disappearing and giving way to sort of more a fancier kind of dining. Some of the newer restaurants, though, in Rome are sort of going back to this tradition, though. I've seen a lot of younger people start to take over these old trattoria, and while they definitely up the food quality and sophistication, they've tried to keep a relaxed atmosphere, which is very nice.
Yeah, and that, you know, that the decor, the sort of the simple or lack of decor, I guess you would say, there is just something very homey about it. But you're right. It used to be, I can remember, because it was a long time back that I was there, but I can remember looking down small alleyways and small streets, and it looked like someone was just having a family party outside their apartment building, you know, in this little narrow street. But in fact, it was an osteria. There would just be some tables, and neighborhood workers were all jammed in. Whether they brought their own food or not, I don't know. But it was not exactly welcoming to an outsider. It was, you had to sort of know about it, you know, and be there and sit down and eat with them. But today there are now, you know, such a variety of dining opportunities in Rome, and the ristorante especially. Now, tell us the differentiation between a ristorante and a trattoria.
Well, when people say ristorante, they tend to mean a place. First of all, it has to do with the offerings in terms of service. And by service, I mean, you know, having a cloth tablecloth, having, you know, different cutlery, having a little bit more sophisticated glassware. But also it has to do with having, you know, several, usually the ristorante will have several, you know, full-time waiters there who are professional waiters. And so it has to do as much about the service as about the food. And the food tends to be a little more sophisticated as well. I mean, although you'll find, you know, a matriciana at a trattoria as well as a ristorante will serve it, you know, use a little bit better ingredients. They'll serve it in a more elegant way. And then of course, there's, you know, very, very fancy ristorante as well, you know, some Michelin-starred places and things like that. But that's a whole other level.
All right. In fact, there was one restaurant that I visited upon your recommendation, and another friend who's been on the show too, and it was called Metamorphosy, and he actually, well, not a Roman chef, I have to say, he's Colombian, I believe.
And right, Roy.
Ray Cotera, right, Roy Cotera, and he actually deconstructed a lot of the traditional Roman dishes. And it was very interesting the way he took those dishes, the flavors of those dishes apart, and then yet presented them on a plate in a non-traditional way, but the flavor was there of that original
right.
dish.
And he's an extraordinarily talented chef, and I think it takes like a lot of talent to do something like that. And you know, Metamorphosy is definitely a ristorante, you know, it's definitely high up there and sophisticated. But what I love also about him is that he's basing his dishes on, you know, Roman cuisine, and he's also kept the atmosphere very relaxed as well.
Right, right. Well, what are some of the major changes that you've, now you've been living in Rome for quite a few years. We don't have to say how many years, but it's been a long time, Elizabeth. but what are some of the changes that you've seen between the popularity of traditional foods versus innovation? Has there been a return to tradition, or is it still strong on the innovation side? What do you see?
As an ever-changing landscape, you know, there were so many years when nothing changed. You know, I've been living here on and off since the 1970s. And up until, say, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, there were really distinctions of, you know, trattorias, the ristorante, and then also bars or also cafes. And places had very distinct profiles, very distinct hours. There were certain things you could eat at certain times. And it was very rigid and also very predictable. A lot of that has opened up in the last 10 years where laws have changed. People can stay open all day long. People can serve whatever they'd like. And so there's been a lot of deregulation in the restaurant scene, for better or worse. Mm. I mean, on the worst scale, I've seen, you know, this proliferation of places that are obviously just aimed at tourists. But on the plus side, there's been a new generation, a younger generation of Romans who are opening places that, you know, they wouldn't have had the money to, say, open a real restaurant previously, but they can open a place where maybe they'll start with gourmet sandwiches. They see that's going well. They start to serve innovative breakfast food as well. You know, then they stay open for cocktails and they're serving something else. And they're able to adapt to the market in a way that they wouldn't have been able to previously. So that's given way to a lot of really exciting new change.
Right. You know, and one thing that I noticed that you actually brought my attention to when I was there is that the whole notion of cocktail hour has just blossomed and boomed, something that I had not seen or had been aware of in years past. I mean, literally boomed so that they're spilling out of the doorways.
Well, that's something that has to do with a younger generation, and which I think is a very positive thing. You know, there's the idea of meeting somebody for an aperitivo. And, you know, in Italy, when you drink, it's not about getting drunk. It's about socializing. So naturally, if you're meeting somebody for a drink and it has alcohol in it, you also want something to eat. So one of the great things now that's happening is there's places where you can go and get a drink and then eat something. Something comes along with your drink as well, and enough to sort of fill you up. And, you know, it's not a heavy meal, but, you know, for instance, my daughters go out and have this, and they meet somebody, and it's their meal for the night, and it's not that expensive. They've had a drink. They've had something, you know, that's fun, that's light. And so this is also another new thing. You know, it's sort of added another mealtime to the daily schedule, an aperitivo or a pericena is what it's called.
A pericena, right. A little bit of food and a drink,
yeah.
Right? That's great. No, and it's a wonderful ambience. You can tell it's just, as you said, very social. It's all about socializing.
Very social.
Sweets. Let's talk about sweets, because that is something that is different in the Italian custom as well. It's dessert is not really part of the meal, but there is a time for sweets, but not at the end of the meal, right?
Well, like for instance, gelato. You know, people love having gelato, but it's sort of hard to. It was very hard for me to figure out when you actually had gelato when I first moved here. And it's this. You know, it's about socializing. You go out, you get a gelato, you go for a walk, and you don't have it right after your meal, but you have it sort of in the late afternoon. And by late afternoon, I mean 5-6 o'clock, more or less right before dinner. So it's sort of something that's. It's a snack. It's something that's a special occasion kind of thing. And in general, you know, Italians, like you said, if you're eating at home at night, you don't have a big dessert. You have fruit after your meal. But on Sundays, you know, if there's a, you know, you have Sunday lunch, that's when you'd have a dessert. If you go out for dinner at a restaurant, you'd order a dessert. So they're always, you know, special occasion kinds of things.
Right, right. Well, it is just remarkable that the food and a lot of the dishes, as you say, for a long time, nothing changed. But it's kind of nice that some things didn't change. And that's, I don't want to end the segment without mentioning, for those listeners who may have not had the opportunity to travel there, to name a few. And of course, we think pasta, of course, is the iconic Roman dishes. And there are a few dishes that are specifically Roman that are still found on many, many menus, and I'm sure you're thinking what I'm thinking. So go ahead and describe whatever comes to your mind.
What
would be just iconic? What would be, yeah, what would be iconic,
well,
traditional?
Have, you know, the iconic pastas, which is cacio e pepe. which is made with grated pecorino cheese and pepper. You should also have, if you add guanciale to that, it becomes pasta alla gricia, which is actually, you know, I think the more delicious version of cacio e pepe, which often gets overlooked.
Right.
If you add an egg to that, it becomes carbonara, which is another iconic Roman dish. And then amatriciana, which is the tomato sauce with made with bucatini noodles and guanciale again. So those you definitely don't leave without having that. If you happen to be here, you know, during artichoke season, carciofi alla Giudea, which is a deep-fried artichoke, is pretty amazing. All year long, I think that, you know, because you're here and you want to partake of sort of customs, a great thing to do mid-morning is go to your local bakery, get a slice of hot pizza bianca, and get it to go and just walk around, you know, munching on your pizza bianca.
Just about the only thing that Romans do eat in the street, right? Other than gelato.
Other than gelato, right, yes, right. Exactly.
Well, Elizabeth, as always, it's just such a pleasure to talk to you. And I want to remind our listeners that your book, again, is called Eating Rome. And you have lots of apps, and you can find out all about these apps at Elizabeth's website, which is ElizabethMinkeelyInRome.com. And we will have that up on our site, on our homepage as well. And all the different apps that you have, it's wonderful. And I thank you so much for sharing a little bit about, a lot actually, about Roman food culture. Thanks again.
Well, thanks for having me, Linda.
And thanks for listening in to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.